I'm Dan Lowry. Welcome to the GCT podcast. Hope you're doing well. Today I'm joined by Yaz Parr. Yaz is a strength and conditioning expert from the UK, currently living in LA. So Yaz has worked with a number of combat athletes over the years. Yaz, thanks for joining us, mate. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
It's a pleasure, man. As you said, my name's Yaz. I'm English from Manchester, but I live in LA, in Long Beach to be exact. I've been a strength and conditioning coach for a long time. '96, I first started working in the fitness industry, but it was 2005 that I actually became a proper strength and conditioning coach. I've got a degree in strength and conditioning, a lot of different certifications that most people would know about. A lot of people have the same ones. I've trained a lot of different athletes in a lot of different sports to go to most big games, world championships, Olympics, etc. But I do specialize in fighters, and I'm lucky enough to just have had a book just come out recently, just published, called Strength and Conditioning for Combat Sports.
Very cool. Keep going.
Thanks, man. Let me see. I don't want to bore people. I moved to LA because I met my wife in Colorado Springs, at the Olympic Training Center. She's a fighter on the US national team, boxing. That's how I ended up over here. We've been in Long Beach now since, 2012. She's just about to open her own gym in Long Beach as well, boxing, so it's not MMA. Might have some Muay Thai there if we can get the right person in. We have got someone in mind, but we'll see. Her gym is called Governor's Boxing Club, as in governor, like a boss, like a gangster, rather than a governor, you know,
rather state than governor. The old style British government. Like you better behave yourself in your marriage, or you might be up for more than you can bargain for. Mate, look, I always find that this is an interesting topic that I come back to, and I've got a bit of a mixed viewership as far as who watches these podcasts, but what I find is that certainly amongst the male viewers and the male listeners, there is at least some interest in the combat sports, whether it be boxing, MMA, or the grappling sports, which are obviously becoming more and more popular. And there's something about these sports which invokes a particular interest in strength and conditioning. And having worked in this area myself, it is a really cool way of expressing your skill set, but also one where, you know, it's probably more than any other sport subject to some myths and misconceptions. What originally was it that got you interested in training combat sport athletes?
I was always interested in fighting, you know. Come from a poor area, and then when I was young, I was Thai boxing for a while. You know, you always look at your main sports of interest, don't you? So even when I was at university, I'd be writing programs for football, what Americans call soccer, and mainly fighting. And then when I met my missus in Colorado Springs, I'd just actually written an assignment for a program for a boxer. So, I mean, from there, that just fell into place. But I don't know. I'm just a typical guy that's from a poor background that has always been into either, I don't mean like trouble causer, but always been into boxing, Thai boxing, and always like watching the stuff on the telly as well.
Mm. Yeah, look, I've always been a bit of a sports nut myself. And the thing that's interested me particularly about MMA, not that I'm any good at it, or have got a background in it myself, but it's just the pure essence of competition. You know, you take the ball out of it, and you take the rules out of it, and you take the reliance on teammates out of it, and you've got one person against another just expressing that will to win.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, in the combat sport, it's not like a team sport. In a team sport, you can have a bad day, you can have a bad game, match, whatever you want to call it, and it can kind of get covered up. I mean, people can see that you're not doing well, but it can kind of get covered up by the rest of the team doing well. Whereas in a combat sport, you're on your own. If you're having a shitty day, that's it. You're in trouble. So yeah, you don't have anyone to pull you out of the out of trouble.
Mm.
So yeah, 100% agree with what you're saying. It's just you in there. Once it starts, that's it. No one's going to come to your rescue.
Mm. And there's of course historically, not only within the world of martial arts, been that argument of who wins out of the karate guy versus the wrestler and all these sorts of variables. But in the world of strength and conditioning and even sports enthusiasts, there's always been that argument of who is the fitter athlete. And certainly with MMA becoming more mainstream, I think that has become widely accepted as probably one of the more challenging sports from a fitness perspective and an all-round fitness perspective.
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, if you're doing the strength and conditioning for, say, a fighter or a boxer or a Thai boxer, it's a lot different to doing the strength and conditioning for a grappler.
Mm.
So, say, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or Judo or any other grappling, whereas with MMA, you have to combine all the qualities from both sides. So, that's what's hard. For somebody who doesn't have much experience in that side of things, it's harder to put the thing together because you have to, not only do you have to make them explosive because they are doing unloaded movement, but they also have to deal with other people's body weight a lot more than in standard fighting sports, like stand-up ones, you know? Because, I mean, you are grappling, so you have to... I mean, you have to hit a lot of different strength qualities, but also stuff like isometric strength and maximal strength a lot more as well. So, yeah, I agree that with MMA, it just you have to put a lot more thought into it to get everything right compared to if it's just a stand-up fighter or a grappler.
Mm. Did that
answer your question? Okay.
Yeah. And of course, leave enough time still for actually getting good at the sport and the skills. What would you say has been your overarching philosophy or the way you look at how you're going to set up a training camp or a training program for a fighter? You know, depending, obviously, there's going to be differences between the different disciplines, but how do you go about it?
You have to look at the sport, as I was just saying, but you also have to look at the individual, you know? Mm. So... I mean, you can get somebody who's fast and they're nowhere near as strong as they should be. Or you can get someone who's strong, but they can't display that strength quickly. They don't have the speed. So besides looking at the sport, you have to look at each individual and see what they need as an individual. So say if you have, if you test an explosive strength deficit, which is not how strong you are, but the different how long it takes you to actually do something. So let me say, this is a one that I've used recently. I think it was when I was writing something. If you have, let's say you have two fighters who can both overhead press, say, let's say, I don't think a number 60 key, and one of them can do it in 0.5 seconds and the other one can do it in 0.2 seconds. The one that can do it in 0.5 seconds has a greater strength deficit, so explosive strength deficit, so he will be at a disadvantage, all else being equal, obviously, against the other guy.
Mm.
The one who's got the greater explosive strength deficit, so the one who takes the longest to actually move the weight, that guy would then have to train for being a lot faster, so stuff like Olympic lifts, plyometric sprints, whereas the other guy would need to work on maximal strength more because he's already can display his strength quick. So that guy would need to work on getting stronger.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Look, exactly the same sort of sentiment I take into it when I'm working with different fighters. It's not a case of, all right, this is the system. This is how I train a fighter. It's more, okay, what are you deficient in? Where do you need to improve most? And there's been instances where I've said to a fighter, look, there's actually nothing much I can do for you. You're already strong enough. You've got a good gas tank. You've got great striking, but you need to go and wrestle. You know, your wrestling sucks, and it doesn't matter what we do in the gym until you get better at wrestling. it's kind of going to be redundant, any lifting we do here, because it's just taking you away from the skill training and taking you away the primary skill. Obviously, strength can start to close the gap on skill, but skill should be number one.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, technique is king.
Mm.
So if someone has good technique and then you improve rate of force development, then that person is going to improve. But yeah, I mean, it's like if you get an elite level fighter, everybody benefits from a good strength and conditioning program. But if someone's right at the top, someone like, I don't know, so let's talk normal boxing, someone like Floyd Mayweather, how much better are you going to make him by improving his squat by 50 key? Mm. You're not going to, but that kind of person, you're probably going to get decent results from, as you said before, looking at weaknesses. So looking at imbalances, fixing the weaknesses in the body, and then that way is going to function better, and you're probably going to prolong the career as well a little bit, whether it's a year, 2 years, whatever. But when someone's at that level, you're probably not going to try and make them the strongest guy on the planet, because it isn't going to make them any better. Oops, sorry. It isn't going to make them any better. And fixing imbalances is going to make them healthier, less susceptible to injury, and you're gonna have positive results physically in that way, you know?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I was actually listening to an interview recently with the middleweight champion, Robert Whittaker, an Australian guy, the UFC middleweight champion. And I was just struck by how many different approaches these guys are taking. And quite often it seems to be by happenance and circumstance more than deliberate action. But he was talking about his strength and conditioning being purely work he did a couple of times a week with a guy who was more of a gymnastics background, a strength coach from more of a gymnastics background. It was really just rocking up to those training sessions a couple of times a week, saying where he was hurting, where he was sore, going through a stretch, but then getting everything else he needed from his specific training. And then, you know, you'll listen to something. Who was it? There was someone on the Joe Rogan podcast one time who was saying, yeah, we've got to a point with our fighters now where, you know, they know how to fight. We don't spar. We just do strength and conditioning coming into that last 6 weeks to really get fit and make sure we can go five rounds. And it just struck me, you know, how different the approaches are out there, and how it almost feels like there's less science than ever being applied in some of these camps.
Yeah. Actually, someone tagged me in a Joe Rogan podcast, and it was the, jiu-jitsu guy with a shaved head who trains Josh St-Pierre. Someone was...
John Danaher.
Yeah, that's it. So someone tagged me in Joe Rogan's, and they said, listen to this bit, and it was actually Joe Rogan brought up that little bit that you said then, that about some guys who were saying that they don't, in camp, they don't work on any fighting stuff. It's all about strength and conditioning. And he was disagreeing with them, saying, in the short amount of time that you're in camp, you can't really improve physically, so it's better to work on technique.
Mm.
Whereas, so it, like, as you said, there's so many different views and ways of looking at it. And I mean, you could have one expert argue and another expert say that they're totally wrong. But personally, I think if they don't practice technique, then they are going to, I mean, some people, they're as good as they're going to get, and they're not going to improve in a way. But if they don't practice technique, then you, like the old saying goes, if you don't use it, you lose it. So you have to practice technique, because that's the priority. So even though I'm a strength and conditioning coach, technique and skill training is always the priority, you know?
Mm.
But I would disagree that when I get employed, mostly it's for camp. And I know I can make a massive difference with someone in camp. And I like... Usually, a lot of the time, people only have like 6 to 8 weeks, but if possible, I like 12 weeks. But I can make a big difference to someone in how much stronger and faster they can be in that time, and obviously fitness as well, so they don't get tired so quick.
Mm.
So in my opinion, camp is technique has to take priority, but for me, it is a massive opportunity to make someone more powerful and be able to display that power for longer. I think, as far as I'm not a technical trainer, but as far as technique stuff goes, I think where it comes in really important for fight preparation is if a fighter knows who he's fighting, which obviously does, especially at a high level, then they know how that guy fights, what is if he's got any faults, how they can be taken advantage of. So a technical trainer would be good to work with them for that kind of stuff, where they know what somebody does and they know how to take advantage of it. But I mean, I guess I don't know, because I don't do technical stuff, I don't know how many hours a day you have to spend on that stuff, but I just know that in camp I can improve someone a lot. But it doesn't interfere with the technical training, as long as it's a pro athlete and they don't have to go and do 8, 9, 10 hours in a normal job, then they can fit it all in, you know. It's not like you have to do one and cancel the other, don't do the other one. As long as you're actually earning enough money, then you can do it all and sleep and eat as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, look, once again, that's my experience of it. I always say to anyone that I'm working with, if you have done all your other training, and as long as you're covering those other bases, then yeah, we can have a big impact on performance.
Right.
However, you got to do all that other stuff first, then we can talk. And that, you know, one of the things I really am less and less a fan of for fighters is that whole camp mentality of, I'm 8 weeks out now, therefore I'm going to start training. I mean, particularly in MMA, you got to be a full-time student of all the different disciplines just to be, you know, a shot at competing at a national level, let alone an international level. You go to that international level, and if you're looking at improving your jiu-jitsu over an 8 week period, or your boxing over an 8 week period, you're up against it. It needs to be a full-time obsession. And when it is, you know, then you can start to bring in your strategy over that camp period and fine tune things like, you know, your power and your power endurance, so that you can put it all together on the day. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's surprising to me. I don't know how often it happens in MMA, but in boxing, you get some guys and they be a decent level, they be professional, and when they're not fighting, when they don't have a fight date, they're there out partying, eating loads of crap, drinking loads, doing, I don't know what drugs they do, but like I say, partying. So it's weird to me, because then you'll see them, and even the guys that are not big, they can still put on like 30, 40 pounds of fat and be out of shape.
Yeah.
And they don't get that. I mean, fair enough, they'll get a fight date, they'll do camp, and they'll be in shape and fit, but they don't get that the lower your starting point is, the lower your finishing point is going to be. And if you don't let yourself get, I mean, obviously you don't have to train like you have a fight lined up like in a month's time or whatever, but as long as you don't let yourself get out of shape and you still train at least a few times a week and stay fit and fairly lean, then when it comes to, if you stay like that, when you do camp and then you're ready to fight, you, that point where you're at then is going to be higher than if you let yourself go. Do you know what I mean?
I think that was the John Jones model you're talking about there. That guy apparently would only go into camp for the last 6 weeks, and the rest of the time he was partying and getting up to fucking God knows what, hitting a heavy bag in his basement a couple of times. But there's certainly those outliers that can get away with that. But man, it's a dangerous mentality when you're talking about sports where you're getting punched in the head if it doesn't go well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he must know what he's capable of doing. And then John Jones is the guy who's been done a couple of times for being on gear, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. He's currently, I think he just had a hearing with the California State Athletic Commission last week or the week before. It's a perplexing case because he tested positive for turinabol, which the metabolites stay in the system for about 12 months on. And he tested positive one day, but then tested negative the next. So there's some funny stuff going on there, and they're just trying to work out what it is,
right,
and whether, in fact, he should be suspended for a long period. But I mean, if that goes against him with his USADA hearing, which is coming up, I think he's looking at 4 years out of the sport.
Wow, that's mad, man. That's massive. But I mean, it's a bit of a weird situation as well, isn't it? If he positive one day and negative another.
Mm.
But you know, I don't know. It's the whole thing with fighters being on gear. It's you can understand. You know, someone can. So obviously, some people use for performance enhancement, and then you have other people who might have done it when they was young, and they were in a way making a mistake, even though they knew what they was doing. And then when they're older, a bit more sensible, they're not on gear. But see, the thing is, even if you was on gear years before, your body still undertook changes that it wouldn't have done. So you still, even if you're clean, you still got the adaptations from being on gear. So you're still at an advantage compared to somebody who's never been on gear.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. My last episode, I actually interviewed Broderick Chavez. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Broderick, but he's somewhat of a subject matter expert in this whole area. And we basically talked about the full story on performance enhancing drugs. And we covered that very thing. You know, it's probably a lot more widespread than what the general public are willing to accept. And those who don't do it are at a huge disadvantage, because like you said, even if you've done it historically, there's going to be permanent changes to your physiology, which are going to help performance.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I don't know who's on gear, who's not on gear, whatever, but see, if you want to be the best in the world and say you're, I don't know, number three or four in the world, and you've never tried performance enhancing drugs, and you know that the people above you are, then what are you going to do? Just settle for always being third or fourth best? Are you going to do the same as everybody else and then become the best? You know what I mean? It's they say that. I mean, steroids is not really my area, and if someone asks me about them, I'll refer them to somewhere else because it's not my thing. I just know about training and nutrition. So, I don't know. It's a big subject, and like you say, most the general population, the public, when they see someone gets done, fails a drug test or whatever, they're all like, oh, it's the devil or whatever, you know. But to be honest, they reckon almost all top. I mean, this might piss a few people off, but most top athletes are on gear, and they say that if someone fails, it's because of a mistake. It's not because all of a sudden that person's on gear and nobody else is. It's because of either a mistake or somebody involved with that person wanted them to fail. You know, it's like, because you're younger than me. Do you remember the sprinter Ben Johnson?
Yeah. I've read quite a few of the books around that whole thing. That was,
Right, yeah.
Cool guy. I feel really sorry for him. Really sorry.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and he got disqualified because, I mean, if they find that you're on performance-enhancing drugs, then you're going to get disqualified, especially if everyone else tests clean. But, I mean, a lot of people still say that. I mean, Usain Bolt's, like, really fast now, but a lot of people say that at that time, even though he was caught for being on gear, he was still the fastest. Because everybody else was on gear, really. It's just that they didn't get caught. I mean, you probably know more about that story than me, but from what I can remember is he admitted that he'd been on gear in the past and come off it then, but in some way, something had been manipulated so he failed the test, even though he was actually kind of clean at the time, even though you can't be clean totally if you've been on gear, but he'd been taking them in the past and then he wasn't then, but he still failed the test. And that's, like I say, that's what people say, that you only fail when you're at that level, because you got a lot of top people around you working out how to mask it, when you should have a urine test, organizing when you should be there, when you can, because I mean, I think, what is it, you're actually, is this true? You're actually allowed to fail a test and then organise it for another, rearrange it for another day, I think.
No, it's, I think what it is it if you're not located for a test. So the athletes have to report to USADA or WADA where they're going to be at any given time. So they're accessible for testing. But if they're not there, it's considered a strike. And I think they're allowed a certain amount of strikes before they're suspended, just for right. not where they said they were. But yeah, I mean, Ben Johnson failed for a drug that he claimed he never took. And him and his coach openly admitted to having used steroids and that being a part of the standard protocol. And it's really interesting reading the books about it, because Charlie Francis, who was his coach, goes into how he basically, with a doctor, ran the whole program. But it wasn't state-sponsored. The Canadian government wasn't sponsoring the thing. Yet the Americans had this whole thing going on where, I think it was at UCLA, they were doing testing under the guise of it being some sort of study. So they'd say to their athletes, hey, we're doing this study at UCLA. We're just testing out this new equipment that's going to be used for testing athletes at the Olympics. Come on in, we'll do some testing for you. And they were using it to see what they could get away with and how close to competition. And if an athlete looked like they were going to fail, they'd say, all right, say you've done a hamstring or just pull out of this next competition. And they were using it as a screening process. So,
right,
yeah, Ben failed that test after running, I think, 9.79 at the Seoul Olympics. And Carl Lewis won the gold by default. But Carl was on anything and everything.
Yeah.
So was everyone else in that field. So, yeah. It's one of the unfortunate realities of sport is that the sponsors and the general public have these huge expectations of athletes to perform, yet we then demonize them when they do everything they have to perform at the level we expect them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know what's amazing to me is, I mean, I don't know what he does or what he doesn't do, but if you look at someone like Usain Bolt, he looks like he's not on gear.
Mm.
And the guy is, who knows how fast the guy can run, because obviously whenever he breaks a record, he makes sure he only just does it because he gets a load of money every time he breaks a record.
Mm.
So, I mean, if he ran all out and smashed the record, he ran so fast that he wouldn't be able to break it again. He would only get one payout, but he never does that. He always just he slows down right at the end, makes sure that he just about beats the record, picks up his money for breaking the record. But can you imagine if he went all out, how fast the guy could actually run?
Oh, man. And every time I watch him and he pulls up 5-10 metres out, I'm thinking, no, keep going.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting, though. I was talking quite a few years ago to one of Australia's leading sports science academics, Tony Bataji, and we're talking about this very subject in particular to do with Usain Bolt. And Tony was saying that the general consensus was that he was probably the only guy who's run sub 10 seconds that wasn't doping. There was a fear
right.
in the sports science community that he was just this freak of nature. He was the only guy that had the stride length that could couple it, you know, due to his height, that could couple it with stride frequency. And that's why he's been able to just run so much faster than anyone else, probably without assistance.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's such a freak because, like you said, he's probably the only. He looks clean, you know.
Yeah.
And he's probably, like you said, though, the academics are saying that he's probably the only guy who has run sub 10 clean.
Yeah.
And that's what he looks like. I mean, he's probably the perfect combination so far of height and physique. Because usually you get him who are tall. Tall and skinny are the shorter and a lot more, and more muscular.
Mm.
Whereas he's kind of, he's the tallest one so far and he's like 6'5".
Yeah.
But
he has.
So he's kind of at the moment, it seems like the perfect blend.
Mm.
He's not too muscular, but he's got a decent amount of muscle and he's also tall.
Mm.
You know, so, I mean, I don't know how long it'll be before someone's faster than him.
Oh man, it's I would think probably once in a generation, that guy. But look, I think it's an interesting segue into another topic that's near and dear to all combat athletes' hearts, and that is the topic of running. Why don't we talk a little bit about energy system development and some of the myths and misconceptions that we see around that whole area for fighters?
Okay.
Road work.
Everyone does road work, and it's always like, if you don't run, our trainers will be like, if you don't get out of bed and run 10, 15 miles a day, then you're not fighting. But I don't know. People who know me know that I say quite a lot about this and post quite a lot. You know, traditionally for me, fighters do too much aerobic stuff. Mm-hmm. They're still running. I mean, I see recently, John, you know, the Australian Thai boxer, John Wayne Parr.
Yeah.
He was saying he runs like 17 miles a day. And, you know, that's real old school. And that's what a lot of boxers do as well. The boxing trainers make them do that because that's what their trainers did, like, to them 50 years earlier and all that stuff. But, so it's traditionally, fighters training for me is too aerobic. But then you also have the younger guys who know more about, they know more about resistance training, strength and conditioning, and they learn stuff, and then they're right, we don't need to do long runs, we're only going to do sprints, we're only going to do intervals, because you don't need to do long runs. But for me, neither is right. You know, you need to have aerobic conditioning, but you also need to do the sprints, but for me, they need to be done at separate times. Mm-hmm. So I prefer people to do a lot of aerobic stuff before. So say if they're going to have a camp, I prefer their aerobic conditioning to be on point before they do camp. And then after that, they only maintain. Maintaining is easy because the aerobic conditioning is the thing that leaves you the slowest. Mm-hmm. So if you're aerobically fit, then you only need, I mean, they reckon 2 weeks, but I would say to be safe, maintenance of only going for a run, like an easy run, 4 or 5 miles once a week, or even just doing your technical training. If you're doing 10, 15 rounds, 3 minute rounds on a bag, or even doing a load of sparring, then you're not going to lose your aerobic conditioning, even if you're not doing specific aerobic work like slow, steady state cardio.
That's right.
But yeah, so for me, I prefer to get that out of the way. I'm okay with for people who want to do hypertrophy training at the same time, or hypertrophy, however you want to say it. But for people who want to train to be strong and powerful, then I prefer them to not do it at the same time. So get the aerobic stuff out of the way, and then you can concentrate on camp, what I call the real training, which is all about adding X amount of pounds per square inch of your punch, and also making it a little bit faster and all that. But if you try and do the strength training at the same time as you're trying to build an aerobic base, then your strength training is not as good as it should be. Plus, your aerobic conditioning doesn't improve as fast as it would, you know? Mm. Let me know, because I know I can waffle on a little bit. Let me know if...
No, it's all good, man. Look, it's I've always found the great irony in being that you'll see some footage of various football codes, whether it be rugby league, rugby union, Australian rules football or soccer or whatever it is, and they'll be doing boxing as their cross-training method, and it's like, okay. And then, you know, you see fighters going and doing running, and it's like, well, why don't you just do the actual thing that you do? And certainly one of the things I can attest to, I like to constantly learn new skills on my own training or be doing a sport or something a little bit more stimulating than just running or lifting weights. And this year I've been doing some kickboxing, just hitting pads with one of the guys I train.
Right.
Yeah, works for me as well. Fuck, man, that's the hardest workout you'll ever do. You know,
it's yep. Like,
why would you go for a run if you can hit pads or do Muay Thai on the pads or hit a bag? It's essentially doing the same thing, and you get to get better at the skill.
Yep.
So yeah, all these sports make me laugh in their attempt to find the secret weapon for getting fit when it's right under their nose.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's kind of mad because you can go on a 5 mile run if you're kind of a little bit fit but not like really fit, but you can go on a 5 mile run and you can be less tired than if you do one round hitting the mitts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but you do need that aerobic base. So that's why I say get it done, get that done and out of the way before you do the proper training. But I'm the same as you. I just can't run. And especially if you're trying to build an aerobic base because your aerobic conditioning is so bad and you're monitoring a heart rate to monitor it. Then if you try and do it running, it can take you an hour to do 4 miles because you have to go that slow to keep your heart rate down. Mm. It's a nightmare because, and I mean, I've had a few fighters who I've told to do that, and they not only do they hate it, but they struggle to do it so much because it kind of feels like they're doing nothing because they want to get stuck into training, and they end up just jogging a little bit, walking fast. Keep stopping to try and keep the heart rate down. So what I started doing recently myself, only a few weeks ago actually, I decided I wanted to build an aerobic base myself because my aerobic conditioning is like diabolical. So I decided to do it hitting a bag instead of running. So what I did is I used the, you know, the Higsol sensors.
No, what are they?
There are a few other companies coming out with some copies now that I haven't used them, but apparently they're not as good. But
do they measure hand speed? Is this the one?
The sensors that go under your wraps.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah.
So they measure speed, but they also measure, I mean, they show like power punches. They don't measure actual power because there has to be like a set resistance to measure power, you know? Mm. But they measure speed and they also measure how much work you're doing. So say if you're hitting the bag for 30 minutes, they measure it on the app. It has intensity, but it's not intensity. I always call it density because it's how much work you're getting done.
Yeah.
But so what I did was I started combining those. So I've got an iPad set up showing punches, but then I've got my phone set up as well with a heart rate monitor on. So then I'm building aerobic base by checking my heart rate and keeping it low while I'm throwing punches, because to me that's a million times more interesting than just running down the street as slow as a 90-year-old woman. Mm. So, and it's really good because you can monitor it like really well. So I noticed the first time, because I don't do aerobic stuff, I had to keep stopping like very, very often, and my heart rate would take longer to go down than what I wanted it to get back, because I want to be doing under 128 beats a minute. I want to be doing between 117 and 127. Mm-hmm. And but I noticed after I've been doing it for an hour, I noticed just after 3 times a week, after 2 weeks, I was in the same amount of time, so in the same hour, I was at the same heart rate, I was landing 1700 more punches. Mm. So, for me, that's a much more interesting way of testing and monitoring rather than me strolling down the street.
And of course, you would have had the altitude mask on while you were doing that.
Yeah, altitude mask on. I had a big resistance band attached to my waist, dumbbells, all the usual crap.
Yeah, man. Let's go over that. I mean, some of the shit. It's like MMA in particular, although boxing seems to be just as bad, they seem to be magnets for training fads, don't they?
Yeah. Can you imagine if you brought out that crappy altitude mask, how much money you would have made?
Oh, fortunes. Fortune. trying to think of what the next thing could be. Maybe I'll invent the next thing and retire in the Greek islands. But the altitude mask, I still get asked about that one too. It's a good one.
Well, yeah, I actually mentioned that a little bit in my book, because I've got a section on altitude training. Mm. But even though that's nothing to do with altitude training and that silly mask, I still have to give it a mention because people think that it does simulate altitude, and obviously it doesn't.
Mm.
Yeah, they're terrible, man.
Yeah, from what I understand, the actual atmospherics need to change to get that altitude-based training response. So you need, I think our normal oxygen content's about 19 to 20%, and you need to be down around 12, 13 to get that high altitude training effect, which putting a mask on won't do. It'll limit how much air you're getting in.
Yeah, maybe. That's it. That's better. Yeah, it doesn't alter the amount of oxygen in the air. It just alters the amount of oxygen that you can actually get into your mouth, you know?
Mm.
In and also out as well, and that's where the problem is, because it's harder to breathe, you have used up in your lungs that is getting harder to get out. So it's a vicious cycle that you can't get more air and oxygen in because there's stuff that you still need to get out. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah, it's just you could think I'm gonna invent the next phase, but you don't imagine if you came up with some idea, you think, well, that's never gonna sell because it's stupid. But that's what happens.
Yeah. Well, the other one I've seen lately is the board with all the lights on it, and they light up, and you gotta touch the light. Seems to be some sort of reaction improvement. I was watching the UFC doco they have leading up to the fights, and Luke Rockhold would be on the Airdyne bike, and then he'd be jumping over hurdles, and then he'd go over to his board and be touching the lights as they lit up for reaction time. So that seems to be the latest iteration of it all.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I would have to test that because I don't think, obviously doing the way you said it, that sounds a bit ridiculous, like getting tired and going straight from one thing to another and all that. But actually doing it to try and improve speed, I think if you can test it and show that you're improving, then it might be good. Because, I mean, obviously, it's a totally different thing to something that's not scientifically possible, like wearing the altitude mask, you know? Because I used to, when I first moved over here and my missus was fighting, I used to train her on some speed and agility stuff. Not like speed ladders, obviously, because I don't do that stuff, but doing stuff like with a tennis ball and a reaction. Sorry, that's my missus.
Family show.
Yeah, so I mean, I used to do stuff with a tennis ball with her, and she did actually get a little bit faster and react a little bit quicker, but it wasn't silly stuff, you know? It was just about making, like, what it'd be is about just making that initial split second movement, about like making it quicker.
Mm. Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say it sort of comes back to that blend of the art and the science. You know, a couple of my guys were asking about the ladder, and they were saying, you know, they wanted to have footwork like Dominic Cruz. They wanted to be fast, and should we be doing more skipping and work on ladders? And I said, well, you know, what makes Cruz so fast is his anticipation and his skill, not working on a ladder. But we can use things like the ladder as an engagement tool, just to warm up on. You know, if everyone rubbishes the sprint ladder and says it doesn't make you any quicker, and the evidence would suggest that, but it doesn't mean that you can't use it as a tool of variety for warming an athlete up and getting them excited about training, getting their emotional arousal to a level where they're going to perform better in their training. So I think there's certainly a space for these different activities when they are put in the right place. So as a tool for engagement, rather as the cornerstone of the actual session and just taking away from something that would have been more useful, like maybe boxing or doing the thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I saw someone pulling out a speed ladder, if I said, what are you doing with that? And they said, I'm just going to use it to warm up. Then I'd be like, oh yeah, nice one, you know? But if they said, it makes you faster and more agile, then I'd be like, nah, you need to put that away.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So yeah, 100%, man. If it's to help someone warm up and get them firing quicker, then yeah, perfect. You can't, you can't say it's no good, but if they're under the illusion that it's going to actually make them faster at the sport and be able to change direction quicker and all that, then they've just been watching too much crap on YouTube.
Yeah, good videos, but won't help you.
Like the little guy with the little guy in the sand with the MC Hammer pants on.
Yeah, man. He's sick.
Yeah, that's it. I always say if Speed Ladder's made you better at your sport, though, then those dance games that you get in arcades, they would make you into a super athlete.
Exactly. Just Dance.
Yeah. Is that what it is? Yeah, that's what they called it.
I think that's the home version.
Right.
Let's maybe play a little bit of a game here to finish. There's going to be quite a few weekend warrior or up and coming fighters, you know, whether it be from grappling sports or MMA or boxing or whatever it is, who are probably going to be listening in for the nuggets in this episode and wanting to know where it is they should be spending most of their time. Obviously, we can't make specific recommendations to that person, but let's go over some general principles for someone starting out, maybe in jiu-jitsu first up, where they can best spend their time on their strength and conditioning to support their development as a jiu-jitsu athlete.
I would say, if possible, they need somebody to identify their imbalances, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, jiu-jitsu would be correcting imbalances and as long as they're not like really fat, then they would be wanting to train relative strength. So become as strong as possible without gaining weight, without getting heavier. Mm-hmm. And correcting imbalances, most athletes, whether it's jiu-jitsu or not, tend to have weak posterior chain, weak external mm-hmm. shoulder rotators, imbalances between the shoulder blades, so mid traps and rhomboids. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I train a jiu-jitsu guy who just became world champion at the SJJIF, is it? The Worlds. He won gold on both days, on gi and no gi. But what I did with him, it was about a year before I started doing stuff to make him more powerful. Before that, it was just all about relative strength and correcting imbalances.
Mm.
You know, so he spent a year, did structural balance at the start, and then after that, it was still always focusing on what was weak, which was identified as weak, which has been his posterior chain, and like I said, external shoulder rotators, upper back. So instead of actually being specific training for structural balance, it was still always more posterior chain stuff. So a lot of like deficit snatch grip deadlifts, wide grip pulls, all kinds of that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, because they're obviously spending a lot of time in their back in a flex position. So we want to do the counter to that. Give them that base, which will make them stronger if they're in the guard or trying to break the guard or maintain their posture. Totally. All right. What if we had a boxer, a beginner, well, an amateur boxer looking to maybe take it up a level, go pro, having done a lot of strength and conditioning? What are the main areas we're going to get the wins for this guy?
With boxers, you tend to find that they either don't lift weights at all, they either don't train at all, or they train kind of like a normal person.
Mm.
You know, someone who goes to the gym and does like 10 to 12 reps, like normal bodybuilding type stuff. So I find that, I mean, obviously that person is going to be different to somebody who doesn't train. The person who doesn't train, they usually, even the ones who train, they tend to not train legs because they think they're just there to stand on. And if they train them, they'll get bigger and then they'll find it hard to make weight or there'll be a heavier weight class. But they have to train legs, man, because force, power comes from the floor, you know?
Mm.
And I find as well that a lot of boxers have low back pain because they don't train the lower body. I mean, when I say train, I mean strength and conditioning. I don't mean they don't do any exercise. But because they don't train lower body, then the hip musculature tends to not work properly.
Mm.
So then they can't generate power from there. So they end up trying to generate it all from the lower back. And as you know, the lumbar spine is not supposed to rotate. So that's why, I meet so many Western boxers that have lower back problems, and that tends to be what it is, because they don't generate power from the hips. Mm. It's all from the lower back. So, yeah, so what I would do with a boxer is, obviously, start out again, same thing again, but the imbalances tend to be different, is fix imbalances, make them as strong as possible for their weight, so relative strength. And that's assuming that they don't need to change a weight class or they're fat or whatever, their relative strength, and then train for improving rate of force development. So the ability to display that strength fast, so they're actually powerful, because there's no point. I mean, becoming stronger generally makes you better at whatever you do, but in a fighting sport, it's of little benefit if you never have time to display that strength. So for me, so say if you could grab hold of someone and pick them up and break the back or whatever on your leg, then I mean that takes a lot of strength. But if if you're a boxer or whatever, then that's irrelevant. You need to be able to produce as much force as fast as possible. So you need a foundation of as much strength as possible relative to your body weight. But then you also need to train to be able to display that strength as quickly as possible.
Mm. Yeah. I like to sort of look at boxing as one end of the spectrum, pure grappling as the other. You know, grappling, you've got time. Boxing, you've got no time. And then MMA is a mix of both. So with that, let's now talk about our beginner MMA fighter. Maybe they've been doing jiu-jitsu for 5 years. They've been doing a bit of boxing, putting it all together now, pretty disciplined with their training. Where should they be spending their time as far as their strength and conditioning goes? General guidelines.
Yeah. Again, relative strength, rate of force development, but with MMA, I think you need to do a lot of isometric stuff as well.
Mm.
You need to work on isometric strength, on explosive isometric strength. So a lot of the stuff in the gym, like max effort stuff against the pins, stuff like that.
I like the triphasic method that Cal Dietz has written a book about. I don't know if you've seen that, but that's pretty cool.
No, I mean, I've seen it. I just haven't read it.
It's essentially contrast training, but you work in cycles. So you do 2 weeks with an isometric focus, 2 weeks with an eccentric. I think it's, no, eccentric first. 2 weeks with eccentric, 2 weeks with isometric, 2 weeks with concentric focus, and then coupling each lift with a ballistic or plyometric exercise. Works pretty well.
Yeah, I bet. Someone was talking to me about that recently, actually, saying it was pretty good.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could get every decent book out there and absorb everything out of them, but it's just, I don't know. I'm a slow reader. Mm. I'm a slow reader, and I'm one of those people as well that sometimes I have to read a page like 6 times to have any idea what I've just read.
Mm. Look, yeah. If you're like me, I mean, what I find is that the principles that I learned 15 years ago just ring true in everything I read. You know, everything I read, whether it be, triphasic training by Cal Dietz or the science and practice, or science and practice is probably a little bit less relevant in this context, but any method orientated book, everything I read, I just relate it back to, yeah, that probably works because of this principle, or that works because of this principle, and that works because of this principle. So, yeah, very, very much the principles over methods.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at all that stuff, all the stuff written by the Eastern European, like professors, masters, whatever you want to call them, that's almost all of that stuff. It stays true. It doesn't. It's not like you can read that stuff and it's right today and then next year it won't be. Almost all of it, it doesn't get proven to be wrong.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So if you can learn the stuff like from, whether it's Zatsayorsky, or Verkashansky, any of that stuff, man, if you can learn that stuff, then you're going to be good forever.
Yeah, that, I mean, that was all the stuff I originally learned. And I remember, I started my career, just so you know a bit about my background, I started my career as a trainer in the army in Australia. That's how I started in fitness. And we learned all that genre of information. And when I went out into the fitness industry, it was during the functional training revolution. And it was all about, you know, transverse plane and unstable surfaces and all this shit. And
it was all the Paul Check stuff.
Yeah. And I got out there and I was like, whoa, I know nothing. All the stuff I got wrong. And then after about 6 months, I was like, actually, that stuff I got taught first was right. That's where it's at. And once again, I sort of chunk in the functional training stuff a little bit like I did with the speed ladder earlier. You know, you can do some cable wood chops or whatever it may be as a bit of a warm up or an engagement drill or something just to get people warm and get them going. But when it comes down to it, it's the bread and butter that's going to get you the best response. And the greatest nuance is much like you've just explained about here with contraction speeds and contraction types. You know, the deadlift is going to be a good exercise for just about any athlete. It's just what kind of deadlift. You know, are we using pauses? Are we using a longer eccentric? Are we using a deficit? And it's just the devil of the detail.
Yeah, definitely, man. Mm. And I mean, I still use like stuff like TRX's, Swiss balls and all that, but they're a useful tool. They're not a way of training, you know. And if you get sucked into the idea that you can do all your training with one piece of equipment like that, then that's where the wheels are going to fall off.
Mm.
You know, it needs to be like that's just a little bit on top of the cake, not the cake's made out of that.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Biggest three things to avoid for all our young up and coming fighters. What are the things they're going to avoid to save themselves wasting time, valuable training time, and potentially maybe even injuring themselves?
There's loads of crap out there, isn't there? Mm. Let me see. Stuff that I see a lot. I mean, obviously, you see stuff like punching with bands and punching with dumbbells and all that. But stuff like, I see people and they... I'm not against swimming. If it's active rest or you're doing some kind of rehab or whatever, I'm not against it for a fighter. But if it's a training day, if you're actually doing it as part of your training because you think it's going to improve your chances of winning a fight, then that's just time wasted.
Mm.
And also stuff, I see people with like sauna suits on like 3 months before a fight. Like they're thinking that little bit of extra sweat that they're going to do is going to make them leaner. It's going to benefit them in 3 months' time. It's like, imagine if I say to you, oh, you got to eat an extra sandwich today because in 2 weeks' time, I'm not going to have any food in the cupboard. You'd be like, what the fuck does that mean? You know what I mean? So sweating 3 months before you fight isn't going to benefit you in any way whatsoever. And also I see them, a lot of them, I don't know about over there, but what's really big in the US is the creams that you get that make you sweat. You get those in Australia.
I haven't, what, like deep heat, that sort of stuff?
Kind of, yeah. But there's ones that are specially made and you put it on, and there's one called Sweet Sweat, and there's a few others. There's a few fighters that have actually got the name on them now, like it's their own brand. And there's also what a lot of boxers over here use is it's a makeup remover. It's called Albaline.
Right.
Yeah, and you put it on and it makes you sweat.
Jesus.
But so I also see people like months before the fighting putting that on, I see someone putting Albaline on or wearing a sauna suit, and I'm like, are you weighing in? And they're like, no. I'm like, so why are you doing that?
Mm.
And they're always told that it will help them lose fat. And I don't know who tells them that. Obviously, old school trainers, but there's only so much you can do with old school trainers if they're not prepared to take on not, it's not so much new stuff, but just open the mind to more, to newer knowledge.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And sometimes there's that many old school trainers, especially in this area, that there's no point in even arguing with them. There's no point, because if they think that if they've had a certain idea for 30, 40 years, you can't just change it. It's like people who argue on the internet. How often do you see someone change their mind by someone saying something different on the internet? People don't.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, stuff like that. What you say? Did you say three? How many have I said so far? Two or three?
As many as you want, mate. As many as you want. Fire me.
What we've already spoke about as well, people, they'd be like really getting close to fighting, and they'll be running 10 miles a day, which is, I mean, it has a negative, not only does it have a negative effect on power, but that could be an hour or two that you could be spent doing something more beneficial, something that is going to make you better, even if it's resting, you know, because obviously rest is, especially like sleep, there is one of the most important things in performance. So if you're running when you've got a fight coming up and you're close, if you're going out running 5, 10, 15 miles a day, then not only is it have a negative effect on power, but it also is just it's a waste of your time that you can be doing something more productive, you know?
Yeah. So more focus on the actual task at hand rather than trying to fill your time up with stuff that's supposedly going to help you.
Yeah. Well, I see a lot of the time you see people and they think if you just pile as much as you can onto a fighter and they're really tired and it's really killing them, then that's beneficial. And then if that fighter can cope with that, then they're fit. They're doing well and they're fit, and then this person is ready or whatever. But I see stuff like, this person ran so many miles, then came into the gym, did so many rounds of sparring, then ran some more miles, and then did some sprints and all that. And it's like, that really is not how it works. You know what I mean? If you, it's difficult if you don't have the knowledge, because it's my area, so that's what I've got a bit of knowledge on. So I can't really comment on technical stuff. So you can't expect like a normal boxing trainer, Thai boxing trainer, MMA trainer, whatever, who specializes in technical stuff to know a lot about strength and conditioning. So ideally, if it's not their area, they should get somebody in who knows a little bit more, even if it's someone who writes programs online or works part-time with them or whatever, because that person, if that's their area, it's going to stop them from doing a lot of crap. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there seems to be that whole scattergun approach of, you know, if we just do a lot of everything, something will hit the mark and the fighter will be fit.
Yeah. That's it. If this person, if he's still alive after we've done this 3 hours of everything we can think of, then the guy's fit. It doesn't take into account adaptations in the body, but also recovery, you know?
Yeah, for sure, man, for sure. And I think that's the really hard thing for somebody who doesn't have that formal training in exercise physiology or sports science. It's just objectifying what's happening. It's putting yourself in that, not only putting yourself in the situation of the athlete, but also sitting down with a pen and paper and saying, all right, what are some guidelines here on how many sessions we can be doing over a 1 week, 2 week or 4 week period? How much is the athlete going to actually be able to tolerate before they start to break down with injury, get sick, or go backwards in their performance? And, you know, how much time do we actually need to spend on those core areas of skill development that are going to make them better? So, look, man, certainly overlaps with my thinking and most of the stuff I do. And it's always good to speak to someone else who has some experience and knowledge in this area, because it's a great way to get clear on your thoughts. And look, certainly the more I talk to smart guys like yourself, Yaz, the more I'm grounded in that belief that it's really got to be about getting as good as you can at the sport and then looking at strength and conditioning from the basics dialed into the subtle nuance of what form of basic is going to be best for the athlete.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they, in my opinion, they need to, being good at the sport is the priority, and then after that, what's going to make them physically much better needs to be programmed, but it needs to be the best results with the least amount of effort.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Icing on the cake, minimal effective dose, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, for sure. All right, mate. I think we might wrap it up there. Let's, for anyone who's keen on following you, you're on Facebook. Obviously, you've got both your personal profile and your coach's page there. And your book, that's coming out soon on Amazon. I think that's right. Or is it already out?
It's the publishing date has already gone, but there is a delay on the paperback for some reason. It's available on Amazon and a load of different sites. In Australia, there was a different site selling it called, I think it's called Book Utopia.
Booktopia, yeah.
Booktopia, is that it? Yeah. So, yeah, so if you put my name and book in Google, then a million different sites come up that are selling it. So, yeah, that's good for me, as you would think. So, yeah, I'm really pleased about that. A lot more work than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, I bet, mate. I'll actually post a link to the book. So if there's any young combat sports athletes here who'd like to empower themselves with a little bit of knowledge and just get their head around what it is they should be spending their time in it, they can read that. And hopefully you can sell enough copies yourself that you can really live it up there in that LA lifestyle, mate, and not have to do too much real work. But thanks for coming on the show. Some great insights there, and always good to speak with someone as finely tuned in the mind as what you are, mate.
No problem, mate. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation.
No worries, guys. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers, mate.